And now, from Washington, the Inside Scoop. All the news the government does not want you to hear. Now, here's your host on the Inside Scoop, Mark Levine.
Hello, America. Welcome to the Inside Scoop. Well, last night, Barack Obama, the President of the United States, sounds so good to say that, President Barack Obama gave what some might call a State of the Union speech. Now, it wasn't technically a State of the Union speech, and that's because technically a State of the Union speech is given, well, at the end of a year. And but President Obama, like President Bush, President Clinton, and President Bush before him, decided to lay out his agenda at the beginning of the year, even though it was the year he came into office. So the Constitution says that the president shall from time to time give information to Congress on the State of the Union. It actually doesn't even have to be an annual address. But really the tradition goes back to the days of the British Parliament when the sovereign, the king, the queen, later on the prime minister, would give their address as to what they expect to happen for the coming year. Today the queen reads the prime minister's agenda, but it's sort of the same thing. That happened in George Washington, John Adams' administration. Thomas Jefferson thought it was a little too regal. He put it in writing. He continued in writing all the way to Woodrow Wilson, who brought it back in public. But Franklin Delano Roosevelt was really the first president to bring it back every year, starting with his 1934 State of the Union address. And he was the first to bring it before a joint House of Congress again and make it the somewhat of a spectacle that it is today. And indeed, I think President Obama's speech, well, rivaled those of FDR. President Obama, like President Roosevelt, tried to comfort a nation, to let us know we would get out of this economic mess we're in and make it stronger than ever. And that's important. It's important not just because we shouldn't have Americans lose hope, but because part of that hope and confidence is necessary to sustain the economy. President Obama made big arguments, bold arguments. He made the argument that government can work. And what's fascinating is that the American people seem to agree. During the Reagan era, probably even during the early years of Bush Jr.'s reign, American people didn't think government could succeed. They tended to believe in things like business. Well, not anymore. Today, 70+% depending on what poll you review, believe that President Barack Obama has a good plan to help lead us out of this depression. That President Obama's stimulus package and his proposals are the ones to get us out of the economic danger we're in. Business is approved by only 30%. And while some may disagree with the stimulus package, you know, it's about 64% for that particular package, what percentage of Americans agreed with the Republican solution? The solution of only tax cuts, that's all? 10%. 10%. 10% is less than the approval rating of outgoing Vice President Dick Cheney. He always at least managed to make it to the teens. Bush would make it sometimes to the low 30s or the high 20s. 10%. And I think it was very clear the off note, the really jarring, I think, way the Republicans are viewed in the United States by listening to the response by Governor Bobby Jindal of Louisiana, which seemed absolutely off note, like he was talking in a different universe at a different time. And frankly, trying to explain things to small children. We'll get to Governor Jindal's response. But I want to go through President Obama's speech. And I also want to encourage you, this is a really good day to call in, and let me know what you thought of either of President Obama's State of the Union, quote-unquote, speech, or Governor Jindal's response. The number, as you know, is 877-4HEAD-ON, 877-443-2366, so you can call on your own dime. 304-658-3333. I'd like to know your impressions as I share mine, so please don't hesitate to call. My impressions are that this is a president who's hitting the ground running, who isn't backing off his campaign pledges, which include the somewhat contradictory notions of pursuing a good liberal agenda, one that most of us here support. Things like moving us closer to universal health care, providing jobs for people, giving us a green economy, getting us off of our dependence on foreign oil, helping kids get a good education all the way through college, and so forth. And combining it with the idea of reaching out to Republicans. Now, President Obama campaigned on both themes, on the themes of what he said he would do. Clearly, he is attempting those. But also reaching out to the other side to listen to them and possibly incorporate their good ideas. And at the time, I said that those ideas can be contradictory. You can be pushed, if particularly if the Republicans stand firm, as they seem to be standing firm now, the great majority of them, into either giving up your ideals in the name of bipartisanship or giving up bipartisanship in the name of ideals. But I think President Obama so far has managed to thread that needle quite nicely. Here's what he does. He says, here's our plan. He goes to the Republicans and says, do you have any additions? Do you have any cooperative ideas? Do you have any suggestions? He listens. He takes the good ones. And if they don't support it, well, then they're off the boat. They're off the bus. But yet every day he welcomes them on the bus again if they want to be. Now, this isn't the take it or leave it of a George W. Bush or even a Ronald Reagan. But what it is at least a willingness to listen. And I don't think that's ever a bad idea, even when it's, God forbid, Republicans. It's never a bad idea to listen. Every now and then, they might even have a good idea. But President Obama began his speech by saying something I've never heard any president say before, at least not in my recollection. The first thing he said after, you know, Madam Speaker, Mr. Vice President, members of Congress, and the First Lady of the United States. The first words he said were, I've come here tonight not only to address the distinguished men and women in this great chamber, but to speak frankly and directly to the men and women who sent us here. That was a really nice touch, I thought. Not, I'm speaking to the people of America, we know that, but to the men and women who sent us here. Obama seems to recognize that we are the bosses of the President of the United States and the members of Congress. He wants to speak to the boss, the American people, the men and women who sent us here. I don't recall President Bush using that kind of language or recognizing that he owed a duty to the people who sent him here. Maybe that's because they were just five members of the United States Supreme Court. But President Obama goes on to talk about why we are where we are. And I want to play a somewhat extended clip from near the beginning of his speech as he explains why we are where we are. Because I think he nicely ties together fixing the economy, which is, of course, essential, with all the long-term problems we've had for a long time, things like energy and health care. And education, things like lack of regulation. Because President Obama understands that this economy is not a short-term problem. Sure, we've got to fix the immediate recession we're in, but that we can do so while fixing the long-term problems at the same time. Yes, you can do two things at once. Remember when John McCain said, oh, no, I can't do a debate right now. I've got to run home and save the economy to support the bank bailout package. And President Obama, then Senator Obama, said, now, wait a minute, you can do both. We can walk and chew gum at the same time. We can do lots of things at the same time. A president has to be able to do more than one thing at once, and this is a president doing lots of things at once. I give him credit for it. Let me play for you President Obama's discussion of how we got where we are today.
The fact is, our economy did not fall into decline overnight, nor did all of our problems begin when the housing market collapsed or the stock market sank. We have known for decades that our survival depends on finding new sources of energy, yet we import more oil today than ever before. The cost of health care eats up more and more of our savings each year. Yet we keep delaying reform. Our children will compete for jobs in a global economy that too many of our schools do not prepare them for. And though all of these challenges went unsolved, we still managed to spend more money and pile up more debt, both as individuals and through our government, than ever before. In other words, we have lived through an era where too often short-term gains were prized over long-term prosperity, where we failed to look beyond the next payment, the next quarter, or the next election. The surplus became an excuse to transfer wealth to the wealthy instead of an opportunity to invest in our future. Regulations were gutted for the sake of a quick profit at the expense of a healthy market. People bought homes they knew they couldn't afford from banks and lenders who pushed those bad loans anyway. And all the while, critical debates and difficult decisions were put off for some other time on some other day. Well, that day of reckoning has arrived, and the time to take charge of our future is here. Now is the time to act boldly and wisely.
So you see what he's doing here. He's making clear, hey, you know, I know this may be called the Obama Depression by Republicans in 5 years, but our economy didn't fall into decline overnight. We've known about the energy problem a long time. We've known about the healthcare problem a long time. We've known about education problems a long time. We have been in short-term government rather than long-term. And it's not just a Republican thing. Sure, that was George Bush. I would argue that Bill Clinton had that idea too. Short-term fixes was the best we could do. Bill Clinton did try in his first 2 years in office when the Democrats controlled Congress. Hillary Clinton tried to do a big health care fix. And it seemed that when that failed, so took the sails out of a lot of Clinton's big ideas. He did lots of small things that were good. But the big ideas went by the wayside. And they did because, let's face it, it's much easier to sell a short-term fix than a long-term fix. A long-term fix causes people to worry about problems for the future. They worry about, socialized medicine. Or they worry about changes to anything that's the way they're used to it. They don't want to get cars that don't guzzle gas. What's an electric car? They never had one. They don't know how it works. How would you fill it up? Change is scary. But in times of great economic distress, change is a lot easier. I mean, a depression is opportunity. Many of our best government programs began in the New Deal, in a time of our greatest economic crisis. And President Barack Obama understands that crisis is opportunity, that he has opportunities that even Bill Clinton didn't have because the country was not in a crisis. I love just the way he says, a surplus became an excuse to transfer wealth to the wealthy instead of an opportunity to invest in our future. You know, instead of talking about the Bush tax cuts, we should just say transferring wealth to the wealthy. The Bush wealth transfer to the wealthy. That has a nice ring to it. He talks about regulations being gutted. He also talks about people and their own individual decisions, making clear that, we all have responsibility too. Seems that the Republicans only point that out, but it is a fair point. Individuals have responsibility. The government has responsibility. Anyway, he goes on to say that he wants his plans, not because he believes in big government, but because, and not because he's not mindful of the debt, but because a failure to act would have worsened the debt. It's amazing to me how the Republicans are newly created deficit hawks. The same Republican Congress that had the largest earmarks in American history, the largest deficit in American history, the largest wasteful spend in American history, including, my personal favorite, $12 billion, was it $13 billion in cash lost in Iraq? Oops. $12 billion in cash. That's a lot of cash. I think Bob once told me it was like 10 or 11 tractor trailer trucks. But there were no complaints about that. Now they're deficit hawks. And there's a reason why they are now deficit hawks. They're deficit hawks because when the Democrats are in control of government, they might use the government to do some good. They might use the government for things other than wars, other than corporate welfare, other than pork. And so now Republicans say, well, we want smaller government. Trust us, we want smaller government. That is never the case, ever. Republicans don't want smaller government. They want different government. They want government that reaches out to different interests. But it's all about trying to put one over on the American people. It's all about there's nothing to see here. Move along. Don't look when President Barack Obama says that 95% of working Americans will get a tax cut. We're going to call that a tax increase. Even though Obama said, and I love the way he said this, he said, we're only increasing taxes on those that earn $250,000 a year. And he said, and let me get the exact quote up here. I have it somewhere here. It's hard to jump around with all this. Here it is. Let me be perfectly clear, because I know you'll hear the same old claims that rolling back these tax breaks means a massive tax increase on the American people. If your family earns less than $250,000 a year, $250,000 a year, you will not see your taxes increased a single dime. I repeat, not one single dime. In fact, the recovery plan provides a tax cut. That's right, a tax cut for 95% of working families. And these checks are on the way. I think the American people have finally figured out that the Republicans are putting one over on them. I think we've got it. I really think we've got it, most of us. Because later on, when Governor Bobby Jindal says, he wants tax increases, it fell like a lead balloon. Going on with the speech, one of the things that I was glad he did was explain why we are giving money to the banks. And even admitting very clearly that he knows that no one wants to give any more money to the banks. That he understands why people are angry at the banks for ruining our economy and don't want to help the people that put us in that terrible shape. And he does talk about holding the executives accountable. But he also points out the necessity of credit. You may not like your banker. You shouldn't like your banker, but banks themselves perform a necessary and important function. And they do. The flow of credit, President Obama said, is the lifeblood of our economy. The ability to get a loan is how you finance the purchase of everything from a home to a car to a college education. How stores stock their shelves, farms buy equipment, and businesses make payroll. But credit has stopped flowing the way it should. Too many bad loans from the housing crisis have made their way onto the books of too many banks. With so much debt and so little confidence, these banks are now fearful of lending out any more money to households, to businesses, or to each other. When there is no lending, families can't afford to buy homes or cars, so businesses are forced to make layoffs. Our economy suffers even more, and credit dries up even further. I remember myself being skeptical of giving money to the banks, and then I listened to the words of my old boss, Congressman Barney Frank, and he persuaded me that it's a necessary evil. It's a necessary evil. Not to give money to these CEOs. I just assume they're all fired and living under a bridge with some homeless people. But to give money to the banks, not because I love the banks, but because they are the lifeblood of the economy. Kevin's on the line from New York City. Kevin, welcome to the Inside Scoop.
Hey, how you doing?
I'm doing good. What did you think of the speech last night?
I thought it was excellent. I was discussing with Bob that I almost feel sorry for Jindal, but... I don't want to keep on running the same joke. you know.
I'm going to play some of Jindal's speech as well and talk about him in the latter part of this hour. To me, it was I can say you almost feel sorry for him. It was such a sad contrast that actually it provided me some laughter. I mean, I really enjoyed laughing at some of the things he had to say. But, yeah, this is the rising star of the Republican Party. Yikes.
The party's in trouble. You know, the party.
Clearly, if this is the best they have to offer, that's pretty sad. I actually expected to do much better. I mean, he's unlike
the Republican Party as we know it ended yesterday.
Well, you know, I mean, George Bush, Sarah Palin, these are not intelligent people. But Bobby Jindal is an intelligent person. But he couldn't give a better speech than that. I mean, he couldn't do it.
Yeah. But the point I wanted to get to, what this country has failed to do for the past nearly 30 years is invest in wealth-building apparatus.
In wealth-building.
Yes. And
be more specific. What are you talking about? Education, healthcare, energy, something else?
Building roads and this whole privatization stuff need to get off the map, because no individual should own a bridge for the public.
I agree with you. I'll tell you something. One of the things that really impressed me, and I don't think many people saw this, but it's worth your time to watch, mm-hmm. was President Obama's conference. It was kind of like a press conference. It happened on Monday. It's during the day. Like I said, I don't know too many people saw it. It was the weirdest thing, and I looked it up. This is when he gave kind of like a press conference to members of Congress. I'd never seen that before. I looked it up. Apparently it hasn't been done since Bill Clinton did it in 1997. I guess that's why I didn't remember it. It never happened to George Bush. After he had his conference, he brought it public, and he called on members of Congress to make comments and ask him questions. And the first person he called on was John McCain.
Mm-hmm.
He even called on Eric Cantor. And, of course, he called on Democrats, too. Anyway, in that conference, there was a person who stood up, and I think it was a Democrat, but it could have been a Republican. I'm really not sure, who talked exactly about what you're talking about, Kevin, about taking away this privatization, that it just hasn't worked. And President Obama
supports
that.
Yeah, and this is how we build. You have to understand, during World War II, what did we target in Germany? Bridges, tunnels, things that produce wealth.
Yeah, okay. Basic infrastructure. And it's not just physical infrastructure, it's things like broadband. You know,
the
invisible that are essential.
Yeah, this stuff generates wealth. Even our educational system. You know, the first thing they cut is arts and music programs. That stuff generates wealth.
I think it has value apart from wealth. No, you think art and music generates wealth? I mean, maybe
yes,
I don't mean
it
to.
Does.
I mean, I think it generates,
you know,
well-being.
Generates wealth. You know what generates wealth? Okay, you got to go back to Adam Smith's principle of taking something that's worth manipulating it till it's worth something. Take a stick in the middle of the road, carve it, polish it, it becomes an axe handle or a cane.
Okay.
And now it's worth something.
Okay.
And that's what generates. And artists think on, you know, they take things that are perceived worthless.
Okay.
And make it into something that people would buy.
I got you. They take an empty canvas and they take a bunch of paint that's valued at $5 and they can create a thousands of dollars paint.
Exactly.
All right. I'll grant you that.
And there has to be a little bit of emphasis on those mechanisms, a bit more. I'm not saying the whole, but you understand my big picture in all this.
Oh, I do. I mean, one of the things I really liked about the speech, first of all, I liked its optimistic tone. I think that, frankly, at the time of inauguration, I have to say, I was out there, you know, with 2 million of my closest friends listening in person to our newly inaugurated president. I felt the tone was kind of down, frankly, and I don't usually criticize Obama's speeches, but I thought this speech last night was much better than his inauguration speech. Now, maybe he was trying at the beginning to, you know, gird us for the recognition that 2009 is going to be a tough year. Maybe so. But you could only keep us depressed for so long. To me, it was the speech last night that was much more Rooseveltian, much more we have nothing to fear but fear itself. You've got to instill confidence in the American people. We have the lowest consumer confidence than probably at any time since the Great Depression. And I was actually glad to see just the entire optimistic tone of the speech. And that also made Governor Jindal's response seem so flat, because he talked about, you know, Obama not being optimistic. And yet this is one of the most optimistic speeches Obama has given since he's been president of the United States.
Well, I think what it is also, that was his very first moment of being president. You kind of need to grow into the part. Give him some slack on that.
Okay. Okay. Well, listen. You know, I'm trying to call it as it is. I don't want to. Obama's not my messiah. I'm not going to say everything he does is perfect. But I did think that last night's speech was even better than his inauguration speech, because he drew it all together. He just brought it all together: the economy and the long term goals. The idea of you know, we do have to care about the deficit, but in order to have a smaller deficit now, we actually need to spend more money now, which sounds counterintuitive, but actually it makes sense, because once the economy gets rolling again, more tax money comes in and so forth. And even when he said, you know, it's not about helping banks, it's about helping people, because that's a tough sell. The majority of the American people understandably are saying, stop giving money to the banks. We need it. And he had to explain that the counterintuitive notion, but I think he's accurate, that, yeah, you got to give money to the banks, whether you like them or not. Not to the CEOs. He spoke very badly about them, but to the institutions, because, you know, the credit is lifeblood of the American people.
Yeah. It's just one of those things where, again, like you said, banks, and I think this could be like a whole reformation of credit and a whole credit and bankruptcy and all that. I think a lot of people who are, because you have to understand, like, our generation has been kind of blackmailed. We really have.
What do you mean by
okay.
that?
But in the form of student loans, you know, we've been kind of pressed into slavery.
Meaning because of the debt?
Yeah.
Personal
and
debt.
There has to be a bottom out situation. Put it to this way, when George Bush Sr. went to Yale, he went on a GI Bill.
Sure.
They gave him the money to go to Yale.
Well, actually, George Bush Sr. probably had plenty of money from his father, Senator Prescott Bush, but others of his generation did.
It was more influence on money. He went to Yale on a GI Bill.
Did he? I didn't know that. I assumed he came from a very rich family.
He did come from a very rich family, but regardless of how wealthy you are, if the college is willing to let you in for free instead of spending what was considered a lot of money back then, a couple of $1,000s per semester, you're going to go in.
One of the things I really liked about what he said is that we need to revamp our education system, and that this actually produces wealth, as you say, for the future. I thought one of his strongest points is when he talked about the fact that, you know, that we created solar technology. But the batteries are made in Korea. Germany and Japan are producing it more than we are. China is making the larger effort in clean renewable. In other words, we create this stuff, and then other countries run away with it because
exactly.
we're not producing it.
Well, it's the television set. You know, bring it back home to the television set. We invented it. Japan mastered it.
Exactly. So, no, I was very impressed. Go ahead.
And, you know, come on, Japan built its empire over Sony. They couldn't do it with machine guns, so they did it over Sony and Mitsubishi and Hitachi and the rest of those.
Well, I just liked the way he brought it all together in a way that was very positive. It was interesting. It was a prescription for bold government, not big government. I mean, it was a prescription for recognizing that the private sector does the work, but that it needs government help to do that,
whether
it is education or it's infrastructure or it's healthcare or it's energy. These are all ways that the government can help Americans solve their own problems. And that's, I think, one reason why Bobby Jindal's response afterwards was so flat, because he was saying, you know, only individuals can help their own problems. And President Obama wasn't saying individuals can't solve their own problems. He was just saying that sometimes you need some government help. And this is a time when polls show, and I don't know that polls have ever shown what they're showing now. 70% of Americans trust the government to do the right thing. Have we ever seen polls that high?
Screwed us.
30% trust business? Have we ever seen that number so low?
Well, who trust business, it's within their interest to trust business, or they're just so far gone because they've been listening to the same false gospel for 30 years.
But, Kevin, I would bet you, and I don't have these numbers, but I would bet that 5 years ago, 10 years ago, 15, 20, 25 years ago, from the Reagan era all the way up through the first 5 years of George Bush Jr., that more people would trust business than would trust the government. I think this is a real thing.
Well, the thing is, 5 years ago, people haven't suffered enough.
Well, that's right. That's right. That's my point. My guess is that the polls of trusting government versus trusting business have not been this high since the Great Depression.
Yeah. They were probably 10 years ago. 10 years ago, we were doing rather well.
Sure. Oh, 2099.
And 20 years ago.
Clinton? Sure. Oh, at the end of the Clinton years, we were doing very well. Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay. 20 years ago, government still had some teeth in. It was still a regulatory engine. It's just when George Bush came and totally dismantled government down to its bare bones. And put a bunch of inept people within this short period of time, people realized maybe perhaps we do need some government.
I'll tell you this, Kevin, after the break, I'm going to play some of Governor Bobby Jindal's response. And to me, the part that I laughed the hardest, the part that was most tone deaf of all, was when Governor Jindal cited Katrina as an example of why we can't trust government.
God, that was sad.
I mean, it was so sad. It was beautiful. It was sublime. Here's Governor Jindal saying, because Republicans don't know how to run government, you should never trust government. Here, we are the people that hate government. You put us in charge, we destroy government. Therefore, government can never work.
Yeah.
It's almost like saying, the Soviet Union, that communist government destroyed the Soviet Union, so obviously government never works. Rather than communism not working. It was an amazing thing. We can never help people. And yet, there were hurricanes in the Clinton era. There was Hurricane Andrew and Hurricane Hugo, and they did none of the damage that Katrina did. There were warnings to fix the levees. I mean, it's shocking what he says. Because we were so incompetent, therefore government is always incompetent. Therefore, vote us in because we hate government. It's like a great little circle here. Vote Republicans in. They destroy the country. Then they say, see, don't vote for Democrats because government destroys the country. Then people vote for more Republicans and there's more government destruction. It's a wonderful little circle there.
Well, you know what the conservative agenda is?
Well, I know what Governor Norquist's agenda is. He said to make the government so small that we can drown it in a bathtub.
If you ever want to see the conservative agenda, as we know, the Republican Party's agenda, rent that Will Smith movie, Wild West. I know it's not the best of Will Smith's outing, but that movie, Wild Wild West, if you ever remember seeing. Okay.
Fair enough. Well, I'll check it out. I need to take a break.
Okay, then.
I need to take a break. But thanks for your call, Kevin. I want to invite others to call in as well. It's 877-4HEAD-ON, 877-443-2366. When we come back, I'm going to play some of the Republican response, just because we all need a giggle every now and then. 877-4HEAD-ON. Be right back after this.
Thinking ahead means preparing for the future of our children, our grandchildren, and our wild, wonderful West Virginia. Developing our renewable energy resources is the best way to ensure a clean, sustainable way of life and safe, good-paying jobs for generations to come. Here in the Mountain State, our most abundant energy resource is the wind. Our ridges and majestic mountain peaks shape and direct the wind like stones in a mountain stream. Coal River Mountain is the ideal place for developing wind power. The Coal River Mountain Wind Farm will provide us with a source of clean energy and good jobs forever. We have the power to make our future happen now. Be a part of the clean energy solution for West Virginia by visiting coalriverwind.org or call 304-854-2182. That's coalriverwind.org, 854-2182.
I'm Matt Rothschild, the editor of the Progressive Magazine, with my progressive point of view, which you can also grab off our website over at progressive.org. I watched Obama's speech, and I was impressed with his performance and his command, and with some, but only some, of what he had to say. I liked his call to bold action, but his defense of government intervention in the economy was neither as fulsome nor as persuasive as the one he offered at his first press conference. In his speech, he gave a quick tour of previous positive public interventions and said, government didn't supplant private enterprise, it catalyzed private enterprise. Well, that's not exactly true. During World War II, government basically ran the economy. And should government's only role be to catalyze capitalism? Plus, did Obama really have to say that he didn't believe in bigger government? He's now in the midst of a tough ideological battle with the Republicans, and he just surrendered an enormous amount of territory. Likewise, he didn't need to propose and then stress that 90% of the jobs in his recovery plan will be in the private sector. Those will be largely non-union jobs and less secure ones at that. Nor did he have to reiterate his pledge to cut the deficit in half by the end of his first term. That's precisely the wrong thing to do in the Great Recession, and he'll either accomplish this goal and kill off the recovery or fail to meet the goal he foolishly set for himself. And while he had the cutting knife in his hand, he also menaced Social Security with it. Now, he did hit some populist notes, like talking tough with the bankers, but too often his coda was oddly conservative. I'm Matt Rothschild. And that's how I see it.
We know you want to save big on your phone bill, and we know how you can.
That's right. We do.
We're saving more than 50% on our home phone bill since we switched to CityNet's digital phone plan.
Really? Over 50%?
CityNet's digital phone plan is only $24.95 a month.
Only $24.95?
You get unlimited local and long-distance calling.
Just $24.95?
And with CityNet's digital phone plan, you keep your current number. All you need is a high-speed internet connection. Get details at citynet.net.
$24.95.
And, oh, this is cool. With CityNet's digital plan, I can use my home phone anywhere in the world with high-speed internet. No extra cost.
There's 20, and there's 4, and there's 95.
Did I mention CityNet is a West Virginia-owned company?
Did I mention $24.95?
Save at least 50% on your residential phone. Get unlimited local and long distance, and keep your same number, all for just $24.95 a month. Visit citynet.net today for more details. Some exclusions and restrictions may apply.
From Washington, more of the Inside Scoop with Mark Levine.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. I was listening during the break to Matt Rothschild's commentary, and I disagree with him. I actually disagree with him a lot. I think that President Obama did hit the right notes in that speech, and I think it's perfectly fine. In fact, one of my favorite lines was the line that he criticized, the one where he said government catalyzes private industry. What a wonderful word. A catalyst, of course, is a small thing that goes in and makes a large reaction, right? You put a small catalyst in a solution, and eventually the solution starts in and of itself. A catalyst is teaching a man to fish so that he can make fish all the rest of his days without needing you to keep teaching him. There's nothing wrong with government being a catalyst for private industry. I don't want an economy run by the government. I agree with President Obama there. I am not a socialist, nor am I a capitalist. I believe in a mixture of socialism and capitalism. I always have. And I don't think pure socialism works, just like I don't think pure capitalism works. Pure capitalism leads to a small group of very rich people and a huge amount of poor people, much like America was at the end of the 19th century. But pure socialism doesn't work either because people don't have any incentives to work hard. No, I believe we need a combination, and there's nothing wrong with President Obama saying that 90% of the jobs will be in the private sector. That's a good thing, not a bad thing. That's not a bad thing. I'm not knocking government jobs. But I'm not knocking private sector jobs either. Yes, they should be union jobs, of course. But let's not knock the private sector. The point is that a well-regulated private sector can do a lot of good, can do a lot of good for the economy. There were good times in Bill Clinton's years, and most of it wasn't through government programs, but through government making it easier for businesses to do the right thing. How do you do that? Well, you regulate them. You make sure they're not defrauding people. You make CEOs accountable to their shareholders. You do things like President Obama's cap and trade system so that the government so that polluters can pollute, but the pollution is limited and only limited to those that give the most bang for the buck, right? They cap and trade it. They sell it. If somebody can make millions and millions of dollars from a small amount of pollution, then it's worth it to them. But you cap the total amount of pollution. These are mixed government-private solutions, and they're the kind that work. Now, obviously, I don't think the private enterprise can do it all. You look at something like healthcare, and the private enterprise has made a huge mess of it. Look at Social Security, and it's absolutely necessary the government provide for retirement. Businesses aren't providing pensions, and God help anyone who had all their money in the stock market rather than relying on Social Security. There are things government does better than private enterprise. There are things private enterprise does better than government, and at times they work well together. I liked that word, catalyst. To me, that's the heart of what President Obama is doing and what he should be doing, not government taking over the economy, but catalyzing private industry. And if necessary, and only if necessary, taking over the economy. Perhaps the best example is the banks. Now, would I support temporary nationalization of some of the worst banks? Yeah, I probably would. There are times when private industry becomes such a mess the government has to step in and take over. Would I support permanent nationalization of all the banks? No. No, I wouldn't. I don't think that would be a good idea. I think sometimes you need people trying different things. So we have a Federal Reserve that's national, that's controlled by the government, but we also have private banks. To me, private-public partnerships are exactly the right way to go, and I think President Obama is doing a good job. One of the things that he did say, by the way, one last quote from President Obama on the banks, is he said that we will act with the full force of the federal government to ensure that the major banks that Americans depend on have enough confidence and enough money to lend even in more difficult times. And when we learn that a major bank has serious problems, he said, we will hold accountable those responsible, that's very important, force the necessary adjustments, provide the support to clean up their balance sheets, and assure the continuity of a strong, viable institution that can serve our people and our economy. He goes on to say that he understands that Wall Street may be more comforted by an approach that gives banks bailouts with no strings attached and holds nobody accountable. But such an approach won't solve the problem. He said, I intend to hold those banks fully accountable for the assistance they receive, and this time they will have to clearly demonstrate how taxpayer dollars result in more lending for the American taxpayer, at which point even the Republicans stood up. The same Republicans that supported giving Treasury Secretary Hank Paulson under George Bush the power to really do whatever he wanted. The reason why there was no accountability is because the Republican administration don't have accountability. And if President Obama does not insist on the accountability, if these are mere words, if the banks are not required to show where every penny is going, if the CEOs are still rewarded with fancy jets and bailout packages, well, I'll be the first to criticize them. I want to move on to, the humor of the evening. To Governor Bobby Jindal, who I thought was hilarious. Almost certainly unintentionally so. And maybe no more so than when he used the example of Hurricane Katrina to argue that government can never succeed. Would you want to have a governor who doesn't believe that government can ever succeed? Listen to what Bobby Jindal said about Hurricane Katrina.
Today in Washington, some are promising that government will rescue us from the economic storms raging all around us. Those of us who lived through Hurricane Katrina, we have our doubts. Let me tell you a story. During Katrina, I visited Sheriff Harry Lee, a Democrat and a good friend of mine. When I walked into his makeshift office, I had never seen him so angry. He was literally yelling into the phone. Well, I'm the sheriff, and if you don't like it, you can come and arrest me. I asked him, Sheriff, what's got you so mad? He told me they'd put out a call for volunteers to come with their boats to rescue people who were trapped on their rooftops by the floodwaters. The boats were all lined up and ready to go. And then some bureaucrat showed up and told them they couldn't go out in the water unless they had proof of insurance and registration.
So what's the conclusion that Bobby Jindal draws from that? That the bureaucrat was wrong? That perhaps the government, the George Bush presidency, should overrule that bureaucrat? That perhaps government could be run better? No, his conclusion is, we don't need government. We don't need government. Hurricane Katrina, the people will just have to find a way out of the floodwaters through private means. You know, as they're on the top of the roofs, as the rivers are rising, let's hope people come and save them. Let's hope so. We don't need government to do evacuation or to let people know the hurricane's coming. No. We'll have private people shot with megaphones. We don't even need government to build levees, right? If private people want to build a wall around the floodwaters of the Mississippi River, which happened to be higher than the land around New Orleans, well, private industry will do it. They'll just do it. If there's a hole in the levee, well, everyone needs to just stand there with their finger in the hole. He really made that argument. Because Republicans failed, because they were incompetent, because Brownie, the Arabian horse trader, did a heck of a job, we can never trust government to do the right thing. And he said it with a straight face. And have you noticed the way he tells stories? Is there anyone else that thinks that maybe Republicans are like little children? Oh, let me tell you, girls and boys, let me tell you a story. Let me tell you about Hurricane Katrina. So the sheriff said, ooh, you should just arrest me too. This sing-song voice, this is the rising star of the Republican Party? This is the guy who's their main nominee for president? He can't even talk to the American people like adults. Listen to how he begins his speech. Listen to how jarring it is, at least in my ears, to hear him praise, you know, the first African-American president, when we have a president who's beyond that already. He's our president. And President Obama is worried about saving the economy. And he didn't mention the historic nature of him being the first African-American president. That's done. It's happened. We're glad about it. Let's move on and roll up our sleeves and get something done. And yet, Bobby Jindal goes on and on about, it's so nice we have a black president. Did anyone else think that sounded condescending? Does it sound to you like he's talking to little children? That he's in the first grade classroom? Let me tell you, girls and boys, this is Bobby Jindal. And this is the way it's supposed to be. Maybe, you know, the 70% of Americans that support Democrats these days, Maybe the infantile speech doesn't work for them, but still does for the 30% that remain Republicans. Listen to how Governor Jindal begins his speech.
Good evening and happy Mardi Gras. I'm Bobby Jindal, Governor of Louisiana. Tonight, we witnessed a great moment in the history of our republic, in the very chamber where Congress once voted to abolish slavery.
Hi, I'm Bobby Jindal. Tonight, we had a great moment in the history of the republic, boys and girls, and it was just really, really wonderful, he goes on to say.
Our first African-American president stepped forward to address the state of our union. With his speech tonight, the president completed a redemptive journey that took our nation from Independence Hall to Gettysburg to the lunch counter, and now finally, the Oval Office. Regardless of party, all Americans are moved by the president's personal story. The son of an American mother and a Kenyan father, who grew up to become leader of the free world.
Regardless of party, boys and girls, we can be happy that this man became leader of the free world. You see, we're not racist in the Republican Party. We like black people, too. Some of our best friends are black. And it's okay. It's really okay. Some blacks are even articulate. Some of them even become president of this United States, boys and girls. But sometimes we disagree. You know, I don't know. Did anyone else think that President Obama talked to us like adults and Bobby Jindal talked to us like children? I mean, one of my favorite moments in Bobby Jindal's speech was when he talked about Barack Obama raising taxes. Raising taxes? Oh, you mean the taxes that are going to be raised on those that make more than $250,000 a year? That's what you're so upset about? Even though President Obama made clear and repeated himself and even said, some are going to tell you otherwise. I love the way he sort of predicted exactly. Well, it's almost like he'd read Bobby Jindal's speech. President Obama said, look, that's only for those that make over $250,000 a year. Bobby Jindal, you're not fooling anyone. He talked about $8 billion in mass transit for high-speed trains, like those going from Las Vegas to Disneyland. Well, first of all, Mr. Jindal, there is no plan on the books that I know of, that you know of, for a train that goes from Las Vegas to Disneyland. But you know what? A high-speed train from Las Vegas to Los Angeles with maybe a stop in Anaheim, would that be a bad idea? You know how many Americans go to Las Vegas every year? You know how many Americans go to Disneyland every year? Do you know how much that helps our economy? You know how many people work at Disneyland and in Southern California? That's one of the main routes. In fact, the whole purpose of a high-speed train is to go where large groups of people travel relatively short distances. That's why a high-speed train makes sense on the Washington-New York-Boston corridor. A high-speed train would make sense in the 4 hours it takes to drive from Los Angeles to Las Vegas. Better a high-speed train than all those cars using all that gasoline. Now, it would not make sense, I'll be the first to tell you, to have a high-speed train from Los Angeles to New York. That doesn't make sense. But Los Angeles to Las Vegas? I don't know. Sounds like a good idea to me. In Japan, they have trains that go to more than 200 miles an hour. In France, they have trains that go more than 200 miles an hour. I thought we started the train, didn't we? I don't know. I don't know who invented the train, the locomotive. But I know this, that America in the late 19th century was the leading train country on Earth. Why do we fall so far behind? Well, because governments like France and governments like Japan were pressing the latest technology, which includes, and I know it sounds fancy to you, Governor Bobby Jindal, but levitation. Sounds like a magic trick, but you know what? It actually works. The fastest trains, believe it or not, run on a current of air. And if that sounds too fancy and too technologically sophisticated for you, Governor Bobby Jindal, I invite you to join the 21st century. Oh, it's such a waste of money. What else did he say was a waste of money? Not the rainforest in Iowa that Republicans approved under Charles Grassley, or even the statues to Robert Byrd approved by the Democratic senator. No, volcano monitoring. That's what he had. That was the worst thing he could complain about. Trains, high-speed trains like they have in France and in Japan between L.A. and Las Vegas, and volcano monitoring. Well, you know what? If you live near Mount St. Helens, you probably want them to monitor the volcano. You know what, Governor Bobby Jindal of Louisiana? You probably would be against levee monitoring, too, wouldn't you? Oh, no, that one's okay? Well, it's okay to monitor the levees that if they break, cause a deluge that causes a whole city to flood in New Orleans, but it's not okay to monitor a volcano that if erupts could put a city in the Northwest under lava? What's the difference, Governor Jindal? You want to monitor the levees and not the volcanoes? No, I take you at your word. You don't want to do any monitoring. After all, government failed in Katrina. Let the people drown. Let them drown. Let them hope that some private industry will get them out. Great. He said so many things. It was amazing. Jindal said that he actually supports health care for everyone. He supports universal health care. You ever heard a Republican support universal health care? Bobby Jindal said it. He just wants it to be provided by private interests. And what incentive, Governor Jindal, will these private interests have to give health care to the poor? The goodness of their hearts, perhaps? Is that what it is? Jindal also talked about the corruption in Congress. Yet I seem to recall the great majority of corrupt members of Congress being Republicans. Yeah, there was the one guy, maybe in your home state, Louisiana, but the rest of them, from Jack Abramoff to Bob Ney to Duke Cunningham, Doolittle, I mean, they were all Republicans, weren't they? And even transparency I found fascinating. Here we have come from the most secret government in American history to the most open government in American history, and Jindal says it's not transparent enough? What other president has put an 1,100-page bill on the Internet at recovery.gov explaining what each and every provision does? Not just the full 1,100-page bill, but an exact numbering of how much money goes to which program and laying it out for every American to see. That's pretty transparent as far as I'm concerned. But perhaps the highlight of Governor Jindal's speech was near the end, and I'm going to try to find this in the last minute or two, where he says that that Republicans lost the people's trust. I couldn't agree with him more.
Distinctions in philosophy became less clear. Our party got away from its principles. You elected Republicans to champion limited government, fiscal discipline, and personal responsibility. Instead, Republicans went along with earmarks and big government spending in Washington. Republicans lost your trust, and rightly so. Tonight, on behalf of our leaders in Congress and my fellow Republican governors, I say this. Our party is determined to regain your trust.
Huh? Republicans lost your trust, and rightly so. You were wrong to trust us. You put us in power, and we ran off and spent like drunken sailors, mostly on, you know, things that would help our friends in the oil companies and, you know, our friends at Halliburton, and to have a few wars, and, well, we lost several billion. But you put your trust in us, and that trust was misplaced. But don't trust the Democrats. Don't trust the Democrats because we were bad rulers. They must be bad rulers. Because we failed in government, government must of necessity fail. This is the best Republicans have? This is the highlight of the Republican Party? This is the future Governor Bobby Jindal? He talks to us as if we were in first grade and tells us that Republicans failed. Well, I agree with him on that one. Therefore, never trust government again. That's their best? Sadly, I think it is their best. You compare Bobby Jindal to Sarah Palin, and he's a regular college professor. They have a bankrupt philosophy. And it's impossible to defend even an intelligent guy like Bobby Jindal, a bankrupt philosophy. And so you had last night the difference between a proud, confident, bold President of the United States and a timid opposition whose only response is no, 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 we failed before, but well, we won't do it again. And by the way, don't trust government because they always fail just because we did. President Obama's agenda is far more bold, far more uplifting, far more optimistic, and I for one kind of want to watch that State of the Union one more time. Hope you enjoyed today's show. Next up, your hillbilly elitist, Bob Kincaid. This is Mark Levine, signing off.